Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. 150 years ago today, the Civil War started, and hour number two of our program, as you know, we're just off a trip to Gettysburg and Washington, D.C., and Mount Vernon, which we took with over 50 of our delightful, informed, caring Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. So the second hour of our program, the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening, Adam Goodhart, will be joining us. He's also writing a daily blog of the New York Times on the Civil War. It's an excellent book, covers so much territory. So we will mark what happened at Fort Sumter 150 years ago and go beyond that, of course, hour number two. The first hour of our program today, we focus a great deal of attention on the budget plan offered by Representative Paul Ryan and the Republican Party, which, of course, Paul Ryan is from Wisconsin. And there's so much news concerning the deficit and who's speaking on this, who's examining it, what needs to happen to cut our debt. The Ryan plan will cut $6 trillion in the coming decade. It would turn Medicare, after about 10 years, into a voucher program, and it would lower spending for the Medicaid program. It largely spares military spending and will be looking at what it does for corporate and high-income taxes and everybody's taxes. Tomorrow, the president is speaking, and you're probably aware that there have been commissions looking at this whole issue as well. What has been called a gang of six senators have been meeting on this, and they have reached agreement, they've announced, on a debt reduction package that is similar to that of the president's fiscal commission. Okay, we're going to talk about both of all of those issues, all those ways to decrease the debt this hour of the program, and we'll have two different perspectives. Professor Christine Rees joining us the first half hour, professor of economics at Ivan Allen College of Liberal Arts, Georgia Tech. She is currently serving on the Special Counsel for Tax Reform and Fairness. Later, Jonathan Gruber will be joining us, professor of economics at MIT and director of the healthcare program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. We start with Professor Rees, who came to Georgia Tech as professor and chair of the School of Economics in 97. She has taught at the Harvard Business School. She's also taught at Duke and at Claremont and at Stanford University. A specialist in international finance, markets and organizations, and economics of the firm in the School of Economics. Her articles include many publications, including those in the Journal of International Business Studies. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Christine Rees, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, so much for inviting me on.
Sure, our pleasure. You wrote recently that the budget plan that was offered by our Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan and the Republican Party is a serious game changer. Give us details. How is it a game changer?
Well, it just it confronts some of the issues that really have not been discussed openly or clearly, and raises a number of the what have been considered like the third, fourth, fifth rail of American politics that administrations have tried to avoid even discussing in the past. So, and by approaching the whole problem as one of cutting spending, the whole budget conversation will also force us to look at our priorities. What the role of government should be in our lives, what's the breakout of our production, how much of it goes back into the private sector, and how much goes into the public sector. That's a discussion we haven't had, and we really, really all need to engage in that and have that discussion.
When you talk about a potentially devastating financial challenge, can you detail what that is, and are we at that point right now?
We are extremely close to it, and with every bit of time that we wait to actually confront these problems, the possible devastation becomes worse. I know that Representative Ryan and a number of folks talk about a tipping point. We are very close to the tipping point where that just be nearly impossible to return from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Erskine Bowles, who is one of the chairmen of the president's Fiscal Responsibility Commission, he said this is one of the most foreseeable financial catastrophes that we've ever known. So everyone knows it's coming. Everybody has known it's been coming for a long time. And I think that our job is really to convince the American people that it's serious and that we all need to really face up to these issues.
Do you think that we had just a foreshadowing of the debate that will come to keep the government open? Did the Republicans and the Democrats really iron out some of these? And are you satisfied with what they did to keep things going, at least until September?
Oh, I don't think we ironed out anything. Well, no, we didn't. We just ironed out the next step. It appears to me this is part of a game. And one of the things I think about, an analogy I think, is in basketball. When you're close to the end of the game and the game is very, very close, and one team has the ball out of bounds and they're going to try to, say, make the team-winning goal. And what they might do is to toss the ball in off the opponent's body so it bounces back out. And it appears to waste time. But what it does is it makes the opponent demonstrate what their strategy is going to be. And all this last weekend when we were going through this CR business, that's what I was watching, both sides trying to see what the other side's strategy was going to be. So I think we are in the first round of this, and I think we got some good information about what their strategies are. And I also think it's very interesting that the president came out almost immediately, or his representative did, and said, whoops, I'm changing my strategy.
Let's talk about what is probably the most controversial part of the Ryan proposal, and I'm not sure I understand it very fully, and that's the Medicare part of the plan. You say that it is the most politically courageous part of the plan, a total reform of Medicare, and unless we solve the Medicare crisis, we can't begin to confront our financial crisis. How does Ryan deal with the issue of Medicare?
Well, first of all, a number of people have asked why he picked out Medicare and included Medicare in his plans and not Social Security. And the answer to that is that nothing works unless you solve the Medicare problem. Nothing. It is huge. It's the elephant in the room, and you have to deal with it. And only when you've got some direction on that can you move ahead with anything else. And what he's really done with Medicare is not really a voucher system. It is a system whereby the federal government blocks grants back to the states, and the states, federal government transfers funds to selected insurance companies so that the taxpayer can go out and select the insurance company that best meets their needs. And then there'll be a portion of that cost will be subsidized by the federal government. And the reason that saves money and the reason that devolving all of this to the states is such a big deal is because if you run everything from Washington, there's going to be one type of health care plan with a certain level of benefits for covering certain areas that is meant to cover everybody in the country. And that's what will be subsidized. Well, there'll be some people that will want more and some people that will want less and some states that want more and less, and some states that have different costs. In fact, all states will. So by devolving the decisions as to what the plans will cover back out to the states, it allows all the states to customize and, in some sense, you know, get a plan that's more bang for their buck. Rather than forcing everybody into the same mold, people are going to be able to pick and choose. This introduces competition in the system, and whenever you get competition, you get two things: lower prices and higher quality. And this is the story of the American success, actually.
And yet you have a system that's been in place for quite some time, and all surveys that I've seen show that this program, of all the government programs, is one that people do like.
Well, people like it now to some extent, though I must say that in the last couple of weeks, I probably know five seniors who've been turned away from their regular doctor because their doctor won't treat Medicare patients anymore. So people may like the system the way they see it now, but what Representative Ryan is saying, what everyone who understands healthcare knows, is that that system cannot prevail. It is absolutely not sustainable. And we've just put the Obamacare plan has put the whole thing on steroids, and we're going to see the quality deteriorate very, very rapidly. So, again, people are comparing to the system that they think they're going to get as opposed to the system that they're really going to get. Mm-hmm. You know, I told this to my students at Georgia Tech last week, and it was really fun there, watch them kind of rise out of their seats. Just to finance the current Medicare package, all of our tax rates, all of our income tax rates have to double, just to finance that. It's a huge, huge portion of our spending plans, and the program was created when I was a child, and we now have, you know what, twice as many retirees as we had when the program was created. Everybody's living much longer, and we have a range of medical care possibilities that are wonderful for all of us, but they're also very expensive. So the plan that you put in place, you know, nearly 50 years ago, you just can't keep the same plan.
My understanding is that things would continue along pretty much as they are now for about 10 years, and then this would kick into place. Is that a correct reading of this?
Well, I do understand that no one over the age of 55 will be forced to change in any way whatsoever, so their whole situation will not be cut. I don't know specifically yet if there will be choices, what will happen with folks that are younger, whether their payments in will change or payments out will change. But the key is, over the long term, the whole system is going to become more self-sustaining. And again, when you introduce the plan, it's introduced competition, and you get higher quality and lower costs always with competition.
What is it that's changed? Are we spending a whole lot more money on military adventures, or is there some reason that healthcare costs have gone up so much that we can look at lowering those in some other way? I'm wondering what's happened now to create this crisis when this program has, you know, pretty much gone along and been okay for a number of years. What's the difference?
Me. I'm a baby boomer. And you just look at, again, I'm going to live maybe 10, 15 years longer than my parents. The health care is much more expensive anyway because of all the new procedures that we have and new medications that we have. And just the number of retirees has doubled since the time the plan was put into effect. It's just not sustainable. The numbers are far too great.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at what the Ryan plan would do for taxes. How would everybody's income level be changed or affected by this?
Well, this is an area that I'm very familiar with because we are in the middle of doing this exact tax reform in Georgia. And it's such a big win for the economy and for the country, and in our case for the state. And the major the idea is it's a reform, not necessarily a tax cut or tax increase. That can be coupled with it, as it was in the Reagan years. But the tax reform shifts the tax burden away from activities that create jobs and shifts it towards consumption. It also would make the tax flatter, so that all the special interest deductions and so on, even the things that we think of as special interests, like personal deductions and mortgage and charitable deductions, of course, this is under the President's Commission plan, too, those special interests would be eliminated, and you'd get basically a flat tax, which would be the same for everyone. So it's sort of, it's shifting our tax burden away from the activities that create jobs. Mm-hmm. And here in Georgia, that's what we were asked to do. When we were commissioned as 11-person commission to change the tax structure in Georgia. And I got to tell you, that any number of states are breathing right down our necks doing the same kind of thing. We were asked to create a tax structure, move things around, and rebalance the tax system so that the Georgia economy would be more efficient and more effective and attract more jobs and more investment. And that's what we did, was we took taxes, recommended taking taxes off of income, personal and corporate, and shifting the taxes to consumption base.
And by consumption base, you mean?
Well, at current, we don't have a state sales tax on food. that's not true in all states, but we recommended putting that state sales tax back on food, which for family of four is about $6 a week, and extending the tax to cover a range of services. Many states tax some services. As anybody, I guess, who thinks about it can see, the whole economy is moving away from a goods economy to a services economy. So if you're going to tax consumption, you need to move the tax towards more services. And then, of course, eliminating the itemized deductions and standard deductions and so on and so forth, and replacing that with a flat tax. And the savings there are just enormous in terms of compliance costs, simplicity, and, again, shifting the burden of tax away from the activity you want to encourage. I have a saying that gets quoted quite a bit, is that if you want more of something, don't tax it. You know, if you want more income, you want more capital gains, you want more savings, you want more job creation, don't tax it. It's kind of simple-minded. But if you look at the current tax system, you can see we've moved really in the opposite direction, and we need to move it back.
And one more question from me before we go to phone calls. There also have, as you well know, been calls of shifting the burden of taxes to those who make a lot of money in this country. We've done quite a few shows on income disparities and the number of people who are at the top, who some are suggesting should be taxed at much higher rates. What do you think of that?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Well, first of all, we know that the people at the top already are taxed at higher rates, and the top 2% of all income earners pay 54% of all the taxes. So at some point you have to say how much is enough, you know. But the point that really gets missed is that most of the people that you would talk of as characterized as rich are people that are, many of them, are running their small business income. In some cases, these are quite large small businesses, running their small business income through their personal income tax. We call it pass-through corporations. So when they get taxed on $3, $4, or $5 million of income, they may be taking out $250,000 for themselves, and the rest of it is the income generated by their company, which, what do they do with that? They plow it right back into the company, and that's what creates jobs. So it's that kind of company, again, that is, since it's taxed under personal income tax, the uninformed would look at that and say, oh, those are rich people. But, in fact, those companies create 70% of the jobs in the country.
And what,
so
what
percent? You tax them, and you're going to lose the job creation machine of the country.
And what percentage of the wealth is found in those kinds of companies? Are you talking about 90% or?
I don't know that number. I don't know that anybody actually has that number. But I think the relevant point, well, first of all, if you were to just tax 100% of all the people that are deemed wealthy, you still couldn't cover the debt and the budget deficit. You just wouldn't do it. So you could tax it completely away. But just let's remember that what we're after here is this job growth and job creation. And that's the whole Ryan plan, is this path to prosperity. And the whole idea is that we've gotten ourselves into a mess by borrowing too much against our retirement income. And the only way out of it, or a major part of the way out of it, has got to be to grow.
Let's go to phone calls, and we'll do that in a moment. We're talking about the path to prosperity outlined recently by Congressman Paul Ryan. We'll hear President Obama's address on the deficit and the budget tomorrow night. Our guests, we have two of them. Professor Christine Rees is professor of economics, Ivan Allen College of Liberal Arts at Georgia Tech, and currently serving on the Special Counsel for Tax Reform and Fairness. Later, we'll speak with a professor of economics at MIT who has a different point of view. To you in a moment, 800-486-8655 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Tuesday, it's the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, which started today. And our guest is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Phone calls now. Jim is our first caller. Hi, Jim. Well, Jim, where the heck are you? Jim, are you there? Let's try Alan. Hi, Alan.
Hi. We keep on hearing about the fact that we keep hearing that we're headed for a financial catastrophe, that it's looming. And yet, tax rates in the last 40 years have fallen dramatically. Your guess says that the wealthy pay the highest, the greatest amount into the financial coffers. That might be true in the aggregate, but as individuals, they've been paying lower and lower rates over the last 40 years. Corporations, the large corporations, have like Exxon, General Electric, and many others have been paying no taxes, and besides that, they get tax refunds. And what about all of the money that's going to fund foreign wars? I don't think we have the reason that we have a catastrophe looming is because most of the money has been going to the upper 2% in this country.
All right, let's get a response. Professor Rees.
Well, just wanted to say something about this notion of the wealthy. And, of course, this is a bit of class warfare. Do you really want to be concerned with what other people make or raise the level of the whole economy? But the way to make the wealthy pay more taxes actually is not to increase tax rates. The wealthy pay more taxes when the economy grows, and the wealthy pay less taxes when the economy shrinks. So by lowering income tax rates permanently and at the margin, you increase the growth in the economy, and what you have time and again is that the wealthy actually end up paying more. So to focus on the tax rates tends to push you in exactly the wrong direction. The other thing I would say is that when we look at tax rates or tax redistribution or progressivity, we are living in the middle of a big, wide world that's increasingly got lower and lower barriers and boundaries. And this coming year, after Japan lowers its corporate tax rate, the United States will have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. And with Illinois having just in January raised its corporate tax rate, Illinois will have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. So when the Bolas Commission and everybody who looks at this problem argues that we should lower tax rate, Ryan argues we should lower them from 35 to 25%. That is putting us barely in line with other countries and gives us opportunity to be more competitive, which we certainly are not now.
What about military spending?
Well, I think the concern really is cutting spending overall. And if you step back and ask, you know, I've got to cut spending overall, how do I want to do that? And I think that what Paul Ryan has done is to open that discussion. Doesn't it make sense to say, let's look at the spending that is giving us what we want? Let's look at our objectives and look at the spending that's meeting those goals. And where the spending is not meeting those goals, let's cut that back. So to ask about military spending or to ask about entitlement spending or spending on education, it seems to me that over the next 2 years, what we're going to be doing is having this discussion, which, again, I started by saying Ryan has kicked off this discussion. We're going to have the discussion of, are we meeting those objectives? Are we meeting those goals? And are those the goals that we share? Mm-hmm. So, for instance, with education, we're the third highest spending per pupil on education in the world. And in most of our subjects, our students are operating at the 50th level amongst all the other countries. That's an example of not matching up the spending with the objectives and the effectiveness of it. So to pick out one thing, I think what you ought to do is back up and say, is this spending getting us what we need and getting us what we want? And that's the discussion we ought to be having.
We have time for one more phone call for you. Then we have to switch perspectives. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. To me, this is just a, you know, rehash of Reaganomics, which is trickle-down theory. But the thing that I wanted to address that I heard Professor talk about was health care, which I think is obviously her and Paul Ryan have never paid for their own health care. Otherwise, they wouldn't be talking about competition lowering the price, because where I live, there are three hospitals, major hospitals. I see billboards advertising each's heart center, or there everyone has a CT scan and all the highest tech equipment, and yet the price of medicine keeps going up and up. If this competition is what drives down prices, then why aren't prices going down? And your bias is clear by calling it Obamacare. That's a right-wing slam on the Health Care Reform Act, which is the name of it. It's not called Obamacare.
All right, let's get a response. Professor Rees?
Well, let me first of all say, yeah, it is a rehash of Reaganomics. And to remind everybody, again, job creation. 2 years after the Reaganomics reform in 86, we generated more jobs than in the 8 years that followed. So it's proven again and again, and we have it across other countries and so on, in that this works. Secondly, if you look at the current healthcare system, there's no way that what we currently have has any level of competition in it whatsoever. Half of the total healthcare spending in the country is spent by the government. So we do not have, at this point, individuals out there checking out the services that they want, selecting the right insurance company, and so on. We don't have that now. And that's what the plan is pushing us towards.
Professor,
away from government control and towards competition.
Professor Rees, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks. For having me.
Our guest, the first half hour, Professor Christine Rees, and she joins us from Georgia, where she is a professor of economics at Georgia Tech and serving on the Special Counsel for Tax Reform and Fairness. We're continuing the same subject, different point of view, the next half hour. Professor Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and also director of the healthcare program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He was on leave as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department from 97 to 98 and was a key architect of Massachusetts' health reform effort. He became in 2006 an inaugural member of the Health Connector Board, the main implementing body for that effort. He was named in that year, the 19th most, how do you come up with this list? 19th most powerful person in healthcare in the United States by Modern Healthcare magazine. We continue phone calls, and here is our number, 800-486-8655. We're spending the hour talking about Congressman Paul Ryan's Path to Prosperity plan and the other plans that may be out there. Professor Gruber, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
We were just talking with Professor Rees from Georgia Tech about the plan. She's very much in favor of this plan. She really believed, and let's concentrate for a moment because you're a healthcare expert on Medicare. It seems to me as though Medicare is going to go away in about 10 years after this plan, should it become enacted. She believes that our system is completely broken, that the federal government is spending half of all our money on healthcare right now, and we're all going to save money and have more choices and lower costs because of the Ryan plan, because we'll have more choices, more competition, et cetera. Can you play out how you think all of this would work if we didn't have Medicare, if we had block grants to the states?
Well, I think we have to separate the two big pieces of healthcare reform in the Ryan plan. So one is block grants to the state for the Medicaid program, which is care for the poorest citizens. That is where his big savings comes from, actually. Comes from essentially saying to the states, we're no longer going to help foot the bill for caring for your poorest citizens. You're going to have to bear it all yourself. We'll give you a block grant amount that is equal to what we're giving you today, but we're not going to raise that over time nearly as fast as your costs increase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the big source of savings in the Ryan plan. There's a lot of discussion of Medicare and the vouchers and things like that. But the truth is, the real big dollars come from really cutting back on Medicaid. In fact, about two-thirds of all the savings in the Ryan plan come from programs for the poor in the U.S. So I think we have to separate the two. So the first one is block grants for Medicaid, which basically amounts to cutting that program over time. The second, then, is these vouchers for Medicare, which are health insurance for seniors, which essentially turns it from a program of a government-provided insurance program to a program where individuals get a fixed coupon, if you will, or a voucher, and choose among private health insurance options. And that plan is that plan has a number of faults with it. I think the number one problem. Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. The number one problem with it is that essentially the voucher it converts to does not grow fast enough over time. So basically, the costs of Medicare are rising very rapidly. They're rising, you know, on the order of 7% a year. The voucher that Ryan would provide would only rise the rate of normal inflation, which is 2 to 3% a year. So essentially, over time, elders would get less and less to offset the cost of their health insurance. The Congressional Budget Office has reported that by the year 2030, the typical elder would be only getting a plan that's worth about 60% as much as they get if we didn't put in place the Ryan plan.
And if
so, basically, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And going back to Medicaid for a moment, if states don't get block grants to Medicaid, how do they fund the program, or do they just not have programs?
Well, so the way it works now, so in contrast to the Ryan plan, the way it works now is the federal government shares in the financing. The federal government pays about 57% of the cost of Medicaid. The states pay the other 43%. And what that means is that's shared on what's called a matching basis. So if there's a recession and a bunch of guys come on Medicaid, the federal government helps pick up the cost. If there's a boom and Medicaid goes down, the federal government shares in the savings. The block grant approach, in year one, the federal government sends the same amount of money to the states it was sending. It just cuts them a flat check. And then that check simply grows at the rate of inflation. It doesn't matter if we hit a recession and millions more people are on Medicaid, the states get no more money. If we get a boom and people reduce off Medicaid, the states keep the extra money. The difference is that check that gets cut, rather than growing as health care costs grow, which is very rapidly, only grows with the rate of inflation, which is much more slower. So states essentially get less and less money over time compared to today's system.
Mm-hmm. It seems as though we're back to that question, which we keep debating, and that's how to keep health care costs from growing so that we can take care of our seniors and we can take care of those who are poor in meeting their health care needs. Are we missing something here?
No, I absolutely agree. That is the number one issue. I think that basically this really comes down to a debate between two views on how we're going to ultimately deal with that problem. One view, which is, you know, roughly on the right, is that the way to deal with that problem is to empower consumer choice. That's sort of the principle behind Ryan's plan, and it sounds like the motivation behind your previous expert on the phone. Basically, if consumers are choosing across plans, they will sort of, through shopping, get prices down the way we think shopping works to get prices down in other sectors. The other view is that, no, the problem is with the supply side of the market, the way we reimburse providers, the way we pay them more, the more stuff they do to people, the way that we don't bundle payments, so doctors and hospitals don't have incentive to coordinate their care. Both sides have a point, but both sides need to be taken care of. And the flaw with the Ryan plan is that basically empowering consumers alone is not enough. There is no way that when a consumer is in an ambulance with a heart attack racing off to the hospital, they can effectively shop for the most cost-effective care. They can't do it. So empowering consumers is not enough. You need to both empower consumers and put in place more effective reimbursement structures for the providers as well.
Let's talk about taxes for a moment. She described his plan as a flatter tax, that taxes will go down for all and that we would have a flat tax. What do you think of that idea?
I mean, basically, the Ryan plan is mislabeled. It's not a deficit reduction plan. It's essentially a government reorganization plan. Mm. Essentially, what the Ryan plan would do is say we're going to cut spending and cut taxes. And in fact, the Ryan plan over the next 30 years raises the deficit. It doesn't lower it. So basically, the Ryan plan is essentially saying not that we're going to reduce the deficit. The Ryan plan is saying we're going to pay for cut taxes to the wealth. We're going to pay for tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans by cutting health care spending. I personally think that's a real skewed set of priorities. Different people can disagree on that, and that's fine. But I think what's unfortunate and problematic is the labeling is wrong. And we need to be important that, remember, the Ryan plan is not a deficit cutting plan. The Ryan plan is a government reorganization plan. And we need to be debating that government reorganization, not giving him credit for something he doesn't actually do.
Mm-hmm. What would you hope the president would say tomorrow night in response to that plan or in offering an alternative?
I hope that the president will stand up firmly and say that we have a commitment in this country to provide health care to our neediest citizens, the poor and the elderly, and a plan which essentially eviscerates that over time. is not a solution, especially when that money is not used to actually reduce the deficit, but just pay for a tax cut for the rich. The president has been very kind and bipartisan so far, and I hope he'll strike a somewhat more partisan tone, to be honest, and really call out Ryan for what's a very misleading plan. And I hope he'll call him out, and I hope he'll say, look, we need to control health care costs. What's the best way to do that? Well, it's what's in the bill we passed. It's what's in the Affordable Care Act. And what's incredibly ironic about the Ryan plan is he essentially gives seniors what is in Obamacare, what is in the Affordable Care Act. He does that for seniors at the same time trying to take it away from non-seniors. What is in the Affordable Care Act? It's people choosing health insurance plans with government subsidies. What is Ryan proposing? That seniors get to choose health insurance plans with government subsidies. So he's both proposing it. What Ryan's essentially saying is that's good enough for our seniors, but not good enough for our non-seniors. And I hope Obama will call him on that and say, look, we need to control health care costs, but the answer is not to blindly cut. The answer is to do it in the kind of smart way we do in the Affordable Care Act.
Professor Jonathan Gruber giving his response to Congressman Paul Ryan's Path to Prosperity plan. We go to phone calls now, and Clinton from Madison. Hi, Clinton.
Hi there.
Hi.
This actually goes back to a statement made by Professor Reese, her statement that the rich pay more than their fair share of taxes based on the statistic that, you know, richest 2% pay 54% of the total taxes in the U.S. I think that is one of the most misleading statistics that is constantly bandied about. The only reason I think that they pay such a high amount of taxes is because they are so incredibly wealthy. I heard a story on NPR a couple of years ago about said that the actual tax rate paid by the high by the richest is closer to like 17% of their income, because they're able to structure their all their income so that it's all capital gains, which are taxed at 15%. So that's all I have to say. I'll take anything off the air.
All right, thanks very much for the call, Professor Gruber.
Yeah, so this is a very good point. The facts are, I think the caller's right. The facts are misleading here. So basically, if you take the top 1% of taxpayers in the U.S., top 1% of families, they earn about 20% of the income in America. So that top 1% earns about 20% of the income, and they pay about 28% of the taxes. So they do pay a higher share of taxes than their income, but that's the idea of a progressive tax system. The idea of a progressive tax system is the rich should pay a higher share of their income in taxes than should the poor. The other fact, the fact that Professor Reese was citing, one misleading approach that's used is to cite just income tax statistics. It is true the rich pay a very high share of income taxes, but remember the richest people don't pay payroll taxes because payroll taxes are capped, and those payroll taxes are actually the majority of tax that most Americans pay. That FICA line on your pay stub and the Medicare line on your pay stub, for most Americans, that actually adds up to more than their income tax. So when people leave that out of tax statistics and say, oh, the rich pay all the income tax, they're ignoring the fact the poor pay all the payroll tax, and that's a huge share of taxes as well.
She also talked about job creation, and what kind of tax policy do you think is best for there to be, and heavens knows we need it, job creation in this country?
You know, I think this is something where the evidence really speaks very clearly, which is basically job creation in the U.S. right now is about demand creation. We have a failure in demand. We have a failure of people having the resources to consume the goods that will create jobs by being produced. And the way you promote demand is not by giving money back to rich people who just save it. The way you promote demand is by giving money back to lower-income people who will spend it. And it's clear from past tax refunds that when the money goes to the richest citizens, they just save that, ultimately passing on to their kids. But when it goes to the lower-income citizens, they actually spend it. Not all of it, but a higher share. And so clearly, if our ultimate goal is to grow the economy, the answer is not to cut programs which provide resources for lower-income Americans in order to cut taxes for wealthier Americans and won't spend the money.
Mark in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there. I don't have a problem with looking at Medicare and Medicaid and saying, well, that's growing becoming a larger percentage of our debt. And I do agree with phasing in a plan over time. I think that's wise. We don't want to shock the economy saying overnight we've got to change everything. But I've seen statistics that seem to indicate that the top 1 or 2% are growing their wealth logarithmically, whereas maybe the top bottom two or three quintiles, maybe down to 60% of the population, are having zero net worth or even negative net worth. And those statistics are moving in the wrong direction. So we're seeing this kind of spike at the top 2%. And for somebody to say, well, they're paying 54% of the taxes, I'm having a hard time getting my arms around the equation when I think that if they've got 98% of the wealth, why don't they pay 98% of the taxes? And this argument that, well, they create jobs kind of baffles me, too, because, you know, I don't know. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Professor.
Well, an MIT professor, I got a little caller who talked about logarithms. I think that basically the caller is exactly right. In fact, what's fascinating is if you look at the median earnings, the earnings of the typical worker in the U.S., in 1970, in real terms, they were 20% higher than today. We've seen an enormous, essentially flattening and ultimately decline of the real earnings of the typical worker. All the growth in our economy, essentially the last 3 or 4 decades, have gone to the very richest citizens. And basically, that is an untenable long-run solution for a democracy. We need to share the growth more broadly throughout the income distribution. Now, you know, and the answer to that is to have a progressive tax system. Now, we can debate how progressive that should be, but the notion that we should have a flat tax system when we've got this ever-increasing inequality, as pointed out by the caller, is just wrong.
More phone calls in just a moment. We're spending this hour examining Congressman Paul Ryan's recent plan, the budget plan, and looking ahead to the president's address tomorrow evening. Our guest this half hour, Professor Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We have some emails I'll get to. At least one of those in a moment. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, 150 years to go ago today at Fort Sumter, the first shot was fired in the Civil War. We'll speak with the author of the very, very interesting and thorough book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening. He says that that year, like 1776, was and still is not just a year, but an idea. Let's go to an email here from Tom. A simple question for you, Professor, that doesn't seem to get addressed. Why are so many important programs fair game for budget cuts like education while the military budget is untouchable?
I think that that's an excellent question, and we need to have a broader conversation in this country about what's touchable and what's not. And I don't understand why cutting, eviscerating health care programs for the poor and the elderly are touchable, and the military budget is untouchable. I just saw a graph yesterday. I didn't realize the statistic that the U.S. actually spends 42% of the entire world's defense spending.
No.
All the defense spending in the world, 42% is done by the U.S. I don't understand why that becomes something that's not touchable in this economy and given the enormous pressures we're facing.
42% of the entire world. I'll remember that one. That's incredible. Pat is next in Brookfield. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I'm all for cutting military spending and also for looking at some revenue sources. But what I think is unfortunate this year, you know, Congressman Ryan is his plan just getting demagogued by the left. And let's remember that 2 weeks ago, President Obama, who is the president of the United States, and I would expect maybe him to lead on this issue, he introduced a budget. And now all of a sudden people are saying, oh, President Obama's budget's going to come out on Wednesday. Well, do we have amnesia? He had a chance to actually strike first and really take a look at deficit and debt reduction seriously. And he passed on that opportunity because he thought politically he would gain by making the Republicans go first, and then he could start demagoguing the plan. My point is, I don't think that's how a president of the United States should act when we all know this is a serious problem. We need to have a serious conversation. And frankly, people saying, hey, we're going to end Medicare as we know it. Paul Ryan's plan is going to end Medicare as we know it. Well, you know what? Medicare as we know it is driving this country into debt, and we need to change Medicare as we know it. And I think it's a courageous plan. I'm not saying it's perfect. We need to make some cuts to the military and potentially raise some taxes. But credit to Paul Ryan for getting this conversation started when our president of the United States didn't have the courage to do that.
Thanks, Pat, for your call. Professor Gruber.
Yeah, I think, you know, Pat, I appreciate your point. And credit to Paul Ryan circa a year ago for getting this conversation started. I agree. His original types of proposals, he had a bipartisan proposal with Alice Rivlin, President Clinton's former, from President Clinton's administration. And that was a very serious proposal that recognized that we need to transform our health care programs, but recognized that the cost of those programs, we still need to allow for some cost growth of those programs. This new Ryan proposal is not serious. He was serious. This new one is pure politics. This is not demagoguing. This is just the fact that he's gone from a world where he's presenting serious concepts to one where he's just trying to score political points. I agree. I President Obama needs to lead on this. I absolutely agree. This is an important, crucial, long-run issue. And I'm very curious to see what he's going to come out and say. The latest says he is going to present a pretty serious proposal to endorse the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which was a commission which had a very serious and actually credible, unlike the current Ryan plan, plan to reduce the deficit. I think the important thing for your callers to remember, for everyone to remember, this is incredibly hard stuff, and it's incredibly easy to make stuff sound deep and important when, in fact, it's just slashing government and reorganizing government. And I think it's very important that we get the objective facts out there and understand who's making the serious proposals and who's not.
Pat, thank you. Carrie on I-43. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking up this topic. It's one that my husband and I have been following very closely. He's a primary care physician. And, you know, one of the concerns that we have that we talk about a lot and it's never addressed publicly on the radio, in the paper, on the Sunday morning talk shows, is the fact that to truly reduce health care costs, you have to do less health care. There's a lot of reasons why health care is so expensive. One is duplication of services. One is misguided incentives to physicians, obviously, is one of them. But, you know, we do things in this country for people who have a very small chance at a quality of life that are very expensive in those last days, weeks, and months of life that don't necessarily result in anything that wonderful for the patient, but are so costly. And the one thing, even though Paul Ryan's plan in so many ways just is, I find, scary, but the one thing that I think the result might be with people paying a finite amount to their Medicare insurance, and I'm not talking about Medicaid, just Medicare, is that you only get so much with that money, and then you have to make choices. Just like as younger working people, we all have to make choices. We're paying higher copays, we're paying HSAs, we have lifetime limits, and I think that's part of the expense, is that there's no limit on what Medicare offers, and so if you're 95 and you've lost your kidney function and you have to decide whether you want to pass on $100,000 to your grandchildren or spend it living a year and a half longer with a very low quality of life, you as an individual have to be forced to make that decision.
All right, let's get a response. Professor Gruber.
I think the caller is exactly right. That's exactly the really difficult decision. And the way to make it is going to make it in an above-board way where people are informed about the costs and trade-offs. But right now, just giving, we have to recognize that just giving someone a voucher and saying, okay, make this decision with no guidance and no linkage with provider discussions and things like that is just not going to work. We need to have a wholly rationalized system where providers aren't paid for keeping people alive for another year and a half. It's not just up to people, right? It's up to the providers, too, as to what treatment. If your mother's dying and you go to a provider and they say, well, you know, there's great things I can do to keep her alive and it'll cost you $100,000, you're going to do it because you feel incredibly guilty if you won't, okay? But if the provider says to you, wait a second, here's some evidence that this stuff won't actually work that well and I'm not going to get paid if I do it, so I don't really care, then all of a sudden you'll make a more rational decision. So that's why just putting it all in the hands of the consumer is not the right answer. We need to put some in the hands of the consumer. I heartily endorse that.
but it needs to be in the context of a rationalized system where providers have the right incentives as
right.
well.
And there's another talk about the tough conversations that we need to have. There's one we need to have, and that's a really hard one, end-of-life issues.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Gruber, for being with us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right. We'll call you again then. Our guest this half hour, Professor Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at MIT, director of the healthcare program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. We thank Professor Christine Rees, professor of economics at Georgia Tech, currently serving on the Special Counsel for Tax Reform and Fairness, for being with us to examine Congressman Paul Ryan's recent budget. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, which all came together last night, actually. Sometimes that happens. You know, you look for a guest and all of a sudden everybody says yes at 10 o'clock the night before. And thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee, where it is sunny, studios. We have news coming up. Please stay tuned for the next hour. We'll learn a great deal about the Civil War. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.